Welcome to Healthcare Entrepreneur Academy, where we seek to educate, motivate, and inspire professionals into starting their own healthcare businesses. Learn from leading healthcare entrepreneurs and other business experts as they share their journey and provide a glimpse into their playbooks for success. Loaded with valuable insights and actionable strategies, this show will guide you on your path to freedom. Now, please welcome your host, entrepreneur and healthcare practitioner, Jason DePratt.
Everybody, welcome to this episode of the Healthcare Entrepreneur Academy podcast. Today, super excited because we have Lo Hornbuckle here. He's the CEO and founder of Sage Oak Assisted Living and Memory Care. Founded in 2015, Sage Oak is the boutique assisted living company with 5 locations in Dallas and a total of 40 beds. Sage Oak also has 2 ground-up boutique assisted living and memory care developments in Texas and Louisiana, totaling just under 300 beds with an estimated value of $45 million. Lo's also active in teaching and educating through his partnership with Residential Assisted Living Academy, which is based in Phoenix. So welcome, Lo. Yep. Thanks for jumping on the podcast with us. And
yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm super excited to chat with you because this is right up the alley of many healthcare entrepreneurs as a possible business opportunity. And so love to hear about your experience. Typically like to start off by asking you to sort of just talk about where you grew up and what your childhood was like and whether or not you had like an entrepreneurial background or family influence or anything like that. And
we're getting deep.
Yeah.
I grew up in a little place called Shreveport, Louisiana. It's also known as Ratchet City. And you go for the gambling, you stay because you got shot. So that's, so I grew up in a sort of a couple hundred thousand person town that, the economy there is kind of up and down all the time. So it was definitely, we weren't worried about where our next meal was going to come from. We had enough money where we weren't worried about that. But, it was never a big extravagant life or anything. My parents are both employees. My mother was a pharmacist. My dad was a CPA, but mostly worked for other people. They didn't really do a whole lot of public accounting work. Mostly was comptrolling or controlling for various companies. When I was growing up, he bought a rental property, like one rental property. Mm-hmm. So I remember that a little bit, but I would say very little entrepreneurial influence in my family. Only child, did a lot of hunting and fishing back in those days. So I would say there's really nothing in my early childhood that would suggest that I was going to be an entrepreneur by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I think it's kind of odd that a lot of entrepreneurs actually have that similar sort of story. No,
interesting.
Or little entrepreneur sort of ties or anything like that. They just sort of make the leap at some point. Interesting. What did you do like when you graduated college and sort of how did you transition into developing Sage Oaks?
Yeah, sure. So I actually didn't finish college. I think mm-hmm. probably one of the biggest edges for me was that I started selling cars at 19. Mm-hmm. So that was a really good experience, because if you think about an automobile, it's a very commoditized thing, right? Like if you're selling a new car, there's potentially hundreds of the same car, even thousands of the same car. So there's sort of a commodity aspect of that. So that was a very interesting kind of different part of sales for me. And, I enjoyed learning that business. Didn't really hit me in the heart, but I learned a lot, formed a lot of business connections, eventually got into sort of the finance and insurance side of the business. And I learned a lot there, really learned a lot about, assessing risk and, whenever you're trying to make decisions about, should we do this? Should we loan this person money? How do I convince a bank to lend this person money? That was probably the key business development skill for me was being able to build, because it's relationship-based selling. Mm-hmm. If there's a bank lender that I'm supposed to call and get a favor worked out or help get a loan done that may be just on the edge of their perimeter, there's a lot of people that can get that done one time. Being able to get that done over and over and over and over again, it's like a well. And you can't draw down all the water or there's none left for the next deal. So that was a really great experience for me to see that, maybe I'm not the best at transactional sales. Like there are plenty of people that work with me that if you needed them to get one deal done one time, might do a better job. But in terms of needing to get, multiple deals done over multiple times, that was something I kind of was able to hang my hat on. Ultimately, my business partner was the owner of the car dealership. So that was a really interesting place for me to kind of not only develop as a business person, but also develop my network that, later, helped launch the company.
Okay. So you use that as sort of a springboard. Was that part of, did you guys go into Sage Oaks together as well?
Yes.
Okay.
So what happened was I moved from Louisiana to Dallas and quit my role at the dealership and knew I wanted to do something. I wasn't sure. I really wanted to leave Shreveport. I didn't leave for anything else. I loved the job and thought maybe I'd go into apartments or potentially go into maybe even sell cars in Dallas. But I really don't want to do that because Dallas car dealerships are kind of famous for just super long hours and just kind of a grind, and even more so than where I came from. But I had a background investing in real estate. I've been investing in real estate since 2010. I owned a bunch of rental properties. So I sort of knew that business and knew that was somewhere I could go, but I never really figured out how to make that into a job or profession. And ultimately, just ran across the residential assisted living model. And then within the span of like 2 weeks, I was at a conference, and then I also heard about it somewhere else. And it was like the universe was telling me, hey, you need to go do this. Mm-hmm. And I had lost my dad had passed away on hospice about a year prior to me forming the company. And there wasn't like a linear progression, but I did sort of all these feelings and all these things that kind of came back where we weren't happy with his care and some of the stuff that happened with him. You know, rather than end up suing the company that provided his care, they didn't do a very good job. You know, I kind of thought this was an opportunity to turn this negative situation for me into a positive for other families.
Oh, that's a very interesting, story. So you started investing in 2010. Was that just sort of like a hobby type thing, just gradual interest?
Yeah,
sort of.
We just bought a bunch of single family homes and renovated them for rent. And it was in the recession, so you could buy stuff really cheap. And it was a great lesson. I learned a lot in that part of my life. I really didn't make very much money doing it and didn't really know what we were doing. Plus, we're doing it in Shreveport, Louisiana. So it's like, how much upside could there be to a rental property in Shreveport, Louisiana? It was a great experience and I learned a lot from that. And again, one of my partners and I was the guy that I was doing the houses with. So a lot of the stuff that I did in the early stages of my life really just did set the stage for the stuff that I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things did you take away from those experiences that you're still using today or you think was really helpful?
Yeah, I think, just understanding the service aspect of it. And my business does have a real estate component, right? There's repairs, there's work orders, there's maintenance things that kind of pop up. There's, turning units over to getting ready for the next client, getting a vendor that can come in and do the painting or repair the floors or do whatever's necessary. So there's a real estate component. Also, most of my projects either do involve major remodels or ground up constructions. So just having that background has been helpful. And then also too, just when you're designing a space, kind of understanding what looks good, what types of color combinations or how you want to approach a space with the natural light provided. So, those are all things that have kind of come into play. But I think in general, it's just my sense of, when there's a problem, get on it, take care of it. I'm not one of those landlords that you got to pester to get something done. It's like, you call me, we'll get it done and we'll tell you it's done and make sure it's done to your satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. So when you first were buying your properties in 2010, were you sort of like one of the hands-on landlords? Were you getting in there doing some of the remodeling yourself, the construction, or did you outsource everything?
I was kind of on the leasing side. So okay. I managed the clients and my business partner who had a audio video company. So he hung cameras and digital signage, stuff like that, low voltage work. And he was pretty handy. So he was doing a lot of the remodel management. So we really kind of had a construction management and then we had kind of a rental. So I was more on the business side than I was on the construction side.
Okay, I see.
You're asking, have I ever swung a hammer? The answer is yes. And then the second time they said, nah, we'll just, There's a great joke. I have a friend that says the only tool he knows how to use is a wine opener. That's probably about right for me. Yeah.
There you go. There's a place for everybody though, and a role for everybody, right? It's knowing your roles. That's pretty important. So when you first got into residential assisted living, how did that sort of, you said a conference, right? And then you heard about it somewhere else. How did that sort of idea sort of spawn itself and then turn into a reality? I'm sure that was quite the process to get your first place and learn the ropes on that.
It really wasn't what you would think it was. Mm-hmm. I think part of the thing about me is when I put my mind to something, I'm going to figure it out. And, that's probably the number one thing I look for in entrepreneurs is, what's their grit factor? How tough are they? Because there's going to be things that happen. And I've faced a whole lot of adversity in building the company. But what happened was, I first kind of started thinking about assisted living in June of 2015. And we'd actually bought our first property in November of 2015. So it really wasn't a long process. I just spent from June to November just studying and working. And I ended up going to a training class. There was a 3-day immersive event in Phoenix back then. And, we had my goal was to have my first property under contract before the year was over. And then we acquired. So we got that in November. And it was a remodel. So it was going to take, you know, 6 months to a year to get ready. And then we bought our second property, which is an operating assisted living facility in March of 2016. So it was only about a 5 month delay between the first deal and the second deal. And the one that was operating only had 3 residents out of 8. So it wasn't being operated very well. And we took that over and then started to work to turn around operations.
Okay. Super interesting. So that first model, investment, what did that sort of look like? What did that entail? What was the facility looking like? How much work was involved with getting it ready to?
Yes. I mean, the first deal was a single family home that was about 3,500 square feet. Mm-hmm. I think it was about 3,800 square feet. And we got it up to about 4,500 with enclosing the garage and kind of moving the patio out. And we made it into a 7-bedroom, 6.5-bath, licensed for 8 beds. So it was a $300,000 remodel to get the up to speed. Really great property. Still, even today, it was the first one I designed. It's still probably the flagship premier assisted living facility in Dallas. If it's not the first, then it's probably second or third to 2 of the other properties that I've done. Mm-hmm. All in all, that was about a $900,000 project. And that property produces cash flow around $150,000, $80,000 a year. So really great numbers on it. It's a really strong project, does very well for us. The second house is really kind of our value proposition house. It rents for about $1,500 per bed less. Mm-hmm. And we like it because, you know, having something in the $3,800 to $4,500 range allows us to have some affordable options for some of our clients. It doesn't make a ton of money, but we do get a lot of referrals from people in that house, and it does help share other. So it's worth having, but it's definitely not, in and of itself, is not really a super profitable standalone facility.
Is it because of the location or the quality of like the finishes on the inside or the quality of service? Is it just
a combination of both? Yeah. I mean, the services between the facilities are the same. It's a much smaller house. It's about 1,000 square feet smaller. Mm-hmm. And so it has private bedrooms, but they're all very small. You know, probably 5 of them are basically maybe 100 to 110 square feet. They're right at state minimum. And then it's got, you know, no private bathrooms or shared bathrooms, for example, just a smaller space. Mm-hmm. So really, in residential care homes, a lot of times the size of the bedroom, the amenities of the bedroom really typically will drive the pricing a lot, at least in the markets that I've seen. So, you know, if you get a big master with a big private bathroom or whatever, it might be $2,000 or $3,000 more than the least expensive room in the house, for example.
Okay. What's a typical like range from, you know, standard small bedroom? You said about 110 square feet is one of the smallest. That's legally allowed in Texas, I guess.
Most states, the minimum bedroom size for a single occupant is 10 by 10. Okay. There are some variations of that, but generally it's about 10 by 10. And then shared bedrooms are generally going to be 160 to 180 square feet. Mm-hmm. I don't really do any shared bedrooms. Most everything we do is private. So I have one room that's probably bathroom and bedroom combined about 500 square feet, and I've got the smallest ones are about 100. So there's a pretty big, you know, difference between those. And a few of my properties have what I call presidential suites. Those are masters that have been converted. And so, they'll often have a husband and wife, living in them or someone that just wants a lot of space. A few of our properties do have a presidential suite.
Okay. Out of curiosity, what's like the typical age range that you're seeing in your facilities?
Probably mid-80s. The national average for assisted living is about 87. Mm-hmm. So we've got, you know, a few younger folks, my oldest resident's 105 and my youngest resident is 32. So for having 40 beds, you mix a 32-year-old in there, you're going to drive your number down a little bit.
Yeah. Interesting.
So we've got a 73-year gap right now.
Uh-huh. And what's the sort of licensing look like? Is it, it's non-medical, right? So the licensing.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's non-medical. It's a social model in Texas. So there's limitations on what we can do licensure wise, but there's also many outside vendors, home health, you know, house call physicians, you know, you can get all kinds of mobile thing, a mobile x-ray, mobile swallow test. You can get blood work. You can also have hospice come into the equation. So it's very easy to bring outside vendors, especially with the Medicare system, that'll come in and cover many of the items.
Okay. Yeah, that makes good sense, especially as you're getting into the 80s. I'm sure there's a lot of extra medical needs that need to be addressed, different than a standard, you know, 30, 40 something year old, for sure. So when it comes to licensing, like what department do you have to get licensed through? Is it like Department of Health? Is it?
Health and Human Services in Texas. Mm-hmm. Just about every state licenses through the Department of Health.
Okay.
And then they may have a subdivision or whatever, but yeah, you get licensed to the Department of Health or Health and Human Services in the case of some states may have like a full standing alone division. Mm-hmm. At one time, Texas used to call it the Department of Aging and Disability Services, but they collapsed it into Health and Human Services.
Okay. And what's that licensing process sort of look like? I would guess that it's a little bit more work up front if you're buying a house, you know, renovating it and then starting from scratch versus buying something that's already been used.
Yeah. Most states have what's called a change of ownership process. So mm-hmm. if you're buying, like the idea there is that if there's a substantial change in ownership, they want you to get relicensed. Obviously the theory there being like, hey, if a squeaky clean person buys a facility and then sells it to someone that has no business being in the business, they want to relook at it and make sure that person is eligible to own a facility, right? Because mm-hmm. not everybody's eligible to own a facility. So a change of ownership is much simpler, a brand new one. And even in some states are not, you know, really free market based on how they look at this. So there are some states that require you to prove demand exists before they'll allow you to license one. So you have to basically prove the sufficient demand exists, and then the state will approve you for building and then getting licensed. Most states are, when there's not government money involved, so if you're doing private pay, if you can build it, they're fine. But some states do require you to prove the demand exists. So you usually get a feasibility study and things like that.
Okay, interesting. And what do those typical licensing fees run? Is it like annual? Is it just...
Yeah, typically annually. Okay. I mean, most states are anywhere from several $100s to several thousand. Mm-hmm. It's not that expensive in the scheme of things. But yeah, it is. It's just really just, you know, following 6, 10, 12, 18 page checklists for the building and for the processes. And most of what the states do is they want you to do, sorry, my dog's just growling in the background. They want you to do what you say. So if you say that, you know, this is our process, that if they come in and they observe you to do that process, that you follow what you said you were going to do. So a lot of it is not them telling you, here's your process. Mm-hmm. It's saying you have to have a process for this, and then you write it or buy it or whatever, and then you have to follow what your written procedure and policy says.
Okay. Yeah. That's actually really similar to running like a medical practice. A lot of the boards will come in and ask you for a policies and procedures manual, and they will just literally just flip through it, make sure that it's there. And as long as you're following it, then they're sort of happy that mm-hmm. you're at least maintaining the standard of care. That sounds pretty similar. What are some of like the typical building, like the actual facility requirements? Like, do you have to have handicap ramps? Do you have to have handicap doorknobs that are easily accessible for wheelchair type things? What's all that?
So that's going to vary by state. Mm-hmm. Some states do require full compliance with either ADA or other accessibility guidelines. And just so no one's left behind, ADA is Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm-hmm. The thing about it is that if you think about ADA requirements as being a burden, that's probably true if you have a restaurant, maybe, right? Like, so if you're having to spend so much and you're only going to gain so much, you know, business from people that were actually going to use the handicap ramp in the example you named.
Yeah.
But in our business, it's really kind of a selling point. Mm-hmm. So I don't really think about it as an expense. I think about it as just a necessary thing we have to do. So it's like, I don't worry about installing ramps or, you know, making doorways wider is an expensive thing. I think about it as, hey, the easier it is to move about in the facility, the more residents we can have and the easier it is to sell. Yeah, I mean, most of our houses do have some measure of ADA compliance. The ones we designed were designed to try to be ADA compliant. The ones we bought that were existing, those rules have kind of changed over the years. In fact, Texas didn't require you to basically be compliant until back in 2015. So some of the stuff we bought that was in existence prior to that, you know, much more narrow hallways, the door aren't as wide, you know, maybe the ramp is functional, but it's not at the right incline. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's some variation there for sure.
Okay. And then I'm assuming there has to be like some sort of a fire inspection of some sort. What is, do you have to have like sprinklers throughout the system, certain sort of?
No, all of our properties have fire suppression, mm-hmm. Fire alarm. You know, the memory care facilities have access control that are hooked into the fire alarm. So the doors can't be opened unless you put in a code. And when the fire alarm goes off, the door will release. Yeah. So generally you'll have quarterly inspections of your fire alarm and fire suppression system done by a vendor. And then the city will come in and inspect you once a year. Mm-hmm. The state or city fire marshal will inspect you. And then the state comes every 2 years unless you have a complaint. So they'll investigate all complaints.
Okay, interesting. If somebody were like wanting to get into this sort of business model, is there any sort of course, book, podcasts, something that we're think we can get some basic information for that's helpful?
Yes. You know, I really have people reach out to me for a few different things. One of them is wanting to get in the business. So for people that want to get into the business, I work with a company. I don't own the company. I help their students, but there's a company called Residential Assisted Living Academy. So Residential Assisted Living Academy, and you can go to their website. They do live training and have some home study courses. There's tons of content online. The guy that owns the place is prolific online. There's a ton of videos you can watch and kind of learn a little about the industry. They'll also do a discovery call for you and kind of walk you through what you can kind of expect. I go to all the 3-day events. So there's 3-day events. I'm now going for about a day. So I come in on Saturday, meet everybody, and then I speak on Sunday and hang around for a little bit because I'm a kind of a busy guy going, I'm not really in the education business. I'm kind of in the assisted living, memory care business, development, capital raising, operations, but I also take some time to help my old mentors, students. So I'll spend a little time kind of helping them out. So the Residential Assisted Living Academy is a great resource. And the analogy that I kind of make is that we get a lot of people that are real estate folks or whatever, sometimes even healthcare folks that want to do this, and maybe they don't understand the real estate part or the real estate people don't understand the healthcare part. So we get a lot of kind of off the wall questions, if you know what you're doing, they're kind of like, okay, these are kind of strange.
Yeah.
So I like people to kind of go through the course because they get like 3 days of immersion. They really understand it. And then all of a sudden the questions start getting better. I don't know if you ever experienced that personally where you're taking someone under your wing. And I personally am not a 101 guy. Like I don't enjoy 101. Mm-hmm. It's like, if they're like showing me like a 6-story house, like, do you think this would be perfect for residential assisted living? I'm like, no, it's really not perfect for residential assisted living. But by day 3, it's like, you know, how should I structure my manager compensation to achieve maximum? You know, then the questions get interesting, right?
Yeah.
So I like kind of having them have a good foundation. So anybody that calls me for help or consulting, I always kind of route them there. And then I'm a resource on their team if somebody gets stuck. So the Residential Assisted Living Academy is definitely a good option there.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks for letting everybody know about that. Now, a quick word from one of our sponsors. This episode is sponsored by my free presentation for the Ketamine Academy. If you're tired of long hours, constantly being on call, or having to give up your nights, weekends, and holidays, all for an employer that only thinks of you as a productivity number that they're trying to maximize, then it's time to break free from the hospital grind, become your own boss, and finally take control of your professional trajectory. It's time you start your own practice. I know it sounds really scary, maybe even a little impossible. I get it. You got student loans, you're working tons of hours, and you may not even be a physician. Well, I am here to tell you that it's absolutely possible. Starting my own clinic was exactly how I started my healthcare entrepreneur career, and there's one specific type of clinic that almost anybody can open. Ketamine therapy is one of the most promising treatments in the fight against depression, PTSD, and chronic pain that we've ever seen. And thousands of patients across the country are looking for clinics in their area. The problem is that there aren't enough yet, and these patients need someone like you to open a ketamine practice in your hometown. Go to ketamineacademy.com/presentation for a no-cost 60-minute training on how to gain more freedom by opening up your own clinic. On the presentation, you'll discover why opening your own private clinic is a better decision than working more overtime or going back to school for another degree, why this one specific niche clinic is the easiest to open and doesn't require a bunch of cash to start, and how anyone can open this type of clinic, even if you're not a physician, by just following a few simple steps. So to register for this free training, just go to ketamineacademy.com/presentation. Now let's get back to the show. Say you're looking to maybe start your first facility, you're starting to like browse the market, and what is there like a certain type of neighborhood that you would typically go looking for? I would assume single story is probably better than multi-story.
Yeah,
what types of criteria are you using when you're first starting to look at the market?
Honestly, that's kind of a classic question that we get a lot, especially the real estate people. They're so obsessed, like I got this house and you know all that stuff. So that all matters. But here's the thing: certain cities and certain states are going to regulate these very differently.
Mm-hmm.
So you really want to be somewhere where the regulations. So you're looking for a combination of the regulations are fair. So for example, in Texas, you're allowed to have 16 people in a residential assisted living facility. Dallas caps you at 8. So if you're outside the city limits of Dallas, you theoretically could have twice as many residents and get the economies of scale that get associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really looking for a combination of regulations, mm-hmm. Affluence, and demand, right? So you could be in a place that has a ton of old people and has really good rules, but if the old people can't afford, you know, reasonable private pay rates, then it's going to be a business that struggles. You know, if you've got a lot of affluent people, but they're not older, then they can afford it, but they don't need the services. So you're really looking at regs, affluence, and demographics. You know, how old is the population? Most major cities do fine on that front, but once a week I'll see someone will tag me in some closed down nursing home or some closed down assisted living facility that's in the middle of nowhere that's been vacant for 8 or 10 years. And they're like, I know you're an assisted living guy. I'm like, yeah, I know that one probably closed for a reason.
Yeah.
It's in the middle of nowhere. It's probably really hard to find caregivers. And there's probably not a lot of people that are going to pay $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year for care, which is kind of the prevailing rates when you do class A stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are things you're kind of looking for. Now the other thing to keep in mind for those of you that are like super entrepreneurial in spirit is you can also passively invest in these projects. So a lot of people want to be in senior housing because they appreciate the demographics. They appreciate helping people, you know, like if you're going to invest in something, invest in something that makes you feel good, you know, helping people fall less and eat more nutritious meals and get more attention. Those are all really positive things you can do in our business, but they don't want to be involved in operations. They don't want to get a 3 a.m. call. They don't want to market it. They don't want to hire a staff. I mean, you know, I have a staff of 40 people. I have basically a staff per bed. And so that's a pretty big, you know, in terms of staff, it's a pretty decent sized company compared to a lot of other, you know, entrepreneurial things you can get into. If you don't want to do all that, you can passively invest. So you can find someone like me and actually put money into a project where we're running it, we're the sponsor, or someone like me, right? Doesn't have to be me. Then you can passively invest in those projects and get a yield on your capital, and then also sort of choose where you want to put your money as opposed to, you know, the stock market or a mutual fund or, you know, buying a single family rental as an example.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So if somebody wanted to get a hold of you, what would be the best way to reach out to you if they're interested in doing the investing?
Sure. Yeah. So the name of my company is Sage Oak Assisted Living and Memory Care. Mm-hmm. The website is The Sage Oak. So TheSageOak.com. And my email address is loe@thesageoak.com. So I'm assuming, you know, when you replay the link, if you just throw that in there, they can click on it. And I want to be clear, listen, if you're in Kansas and you're looking for a assisted living facility for your grandmother who has Alzheimer's, reach out to me because I may have a person that I know in the area that can help you, or I can give you some advice. You know, obviously, if you want to learn about the Residential Assisted Living Academy, I think that's a great resource. And then if you want to learn more about the investing side, you know, feel free to reach out. So it doesn't have to be limited to people that just want to invest. You know, I'm happy to help. And I have people all the time that are like, hey, I'm in LA. Like, who should I talk to? And if I've got somebody out there, I'll certainly make the connection.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sure the audience will appreciate that for sure. When it comes to staffing, you had mentioned that you have a staff of 40. That's a lot. what types of staff? I mean, I would guess cooks, some caregivers. What other types of staff do you have?
Yeah. So in my Dallas operation, our staff are universal. So the mm-hmm. staff are going to cook, clean, do ADL care. So that's activities of daily living. Somebody's left behind. So basically, you know, activities of daily living is, you know, grooming, mm-hmm. meals, medication, taking the trash out, just anything you need to do to live throughout the day. So our staff kind of does all of that. And then overseeing that staff, we have, you know, a nurse. We've got an administrator who's got his master's in gerontology. I have a regional manager whose background is running a skilled nursing facility, a licensed administrator. So it's kind of a mixed mash of caregivers and also, you know, healthcare professionals that run the company. And the ground up developments, we will have chefs in many of the facilities, and then, you know, a little bit more robust teams and sizes because of those types of things. So you've got pretty much HR, you've got, you know, administrators, you know, marketing, sales, activity directors. Someone goes around, make sure the residents are engaged. You know, you pretty much have everything you gotta have on the team. So yeah, it's a lot to manage all that. And you know, we've got a real, you know, I'm not sure if this, your podcast has addressed this in the past, but we've got a massive shortage mm-hmm. of healthcare workers across the board. It shows up in nursing numbers. It shows up especially in caregivers or nurse aid numbers as well. You know, I think in the next 10 years, we're going to have a 1 million caregiver shortage in America, 1 million. And so, you know, it's hard to find good people. And, you know, even if you want to pay, you know, as high as you possibly can, then you got to raise the prices. And it's kind of hard to find people that want to pay $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a month for assisted living. Right now, the average price for assisted living is about $4,000 for a private room in America. It's probably about $5,500 a month for memory care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, already the average is $48,000 to, you know, $60,000. If you want to really get serious about the caregiver shortage and pay more for those positions, then you're obviously going to have, you know, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a month assisted living. So it's a real challenge right now in our business. You know, if you talk to the most CEOs in this space, what they're really worried about is staffing, staffing, and staffing. And then also, you know, how to retain good staff without overpricing their products where people can't afford them.
Right.
It's really it's a real problem in the business right now. And there has to probably be some sort of political solution, not to delve into party politics, but basically there's a ton of people that would like to come to America that would like to do these jobs, and we don't allow enough of them in.
Yeah.
So you're not going to solve a million caregiver shortage without literally bringing people into the country for that sole purpose, because there's just, you know, we have record low unemployment now. Where are they going to come from? You know, what sectors of the economy? So there is some hope in that, you know, right now there's a lot of jobs in fast food, jobs in retail. They're kind of starting to go away a little bit. And so some of those jobs are sliding in or warehouse or logistics, but you know, hopefully some of those people too will reconsider careers in healthcare just because, you know, frankly, it's a booming industry and we need all the help we can get.
Yeah, absolutely. The same thing in the hospital system is there's a shortage from, you know, all the way from techs or nurse aides all the way up to physicians. It's all the way across the board. So yeah, that's definitely something that's, we're going to be, as the population gets older and older, we're going to be facing those challenges much more.
Yeah. And it's crazy because you've got, you know, you've already got rampant price inflation in pretty much every healthcare sector, right? Mm-hmm. It's rampant inflation. And the wages for the direct care staff really hasn't tracked and kept up with that. And if it ever does, then you've got this runaway inflation train already happening in healthcare pricing. And that's, you know, for anything, right? And then you've got this wage trick at the bottom. So it's a really, really precarious tightrope that's being walked by our current system. Regardless of whatever you think about our current system, good or bad, we're really basically trying to decide who is going to ration care.
Yeah.
That's really what it is, right? Like we cannot provide everyone that needs healthcare with healthcare. So we create these gatekeepers, right? Right now it's, do you have the money for it? Do you have insurance? And other countries that have a more sort of government-based payer system, the wait lists are longer. The government is the gatekeeper as far as what you can and can't do. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think what no one really wants to talk about is not everybody that has a broken leg or has a sore throat or needs assisted living can fit through the door, right? The door is too small for everyone to go through at present because we can't deliver it. And so the current system is what it is. And, you know, we're going to have to really radically rethink how we want to do healthcare in a lot of different ways in order to make the door wider so that everyone that needs care and you know, in my opinion, deserves care can go through the door. It's just too narrow at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more for sure. When it comes to, out of curiosity, your ground up versus the places that the facilities that you're buying, what's the major difference there? Assuming you have a lot of control over exactly how they're designed and sized and everything else, what are the biggest differences that you have?
Well, the ground up is a key piece, but I'm doing a campus design. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm not against large assisted living. I always have to make that clear because I criticize the crap out of them. But I think they have too much market share. So in essence, imagine if there was one car in America. Like, this is the American car. This is all we can drive. You're like, well, no, people have different needs. The market share right now by large box assisted living is so high that there needs to be alternatives. Because just like if you're looking for, we're putting in parlance, people understand, if you're looking for a rental property, you could choose an apartment or you could choose a single family home. And there's obviously options in between. But a lot of people want to live in an apartment for very specific reasons. And a lot of people want to live in a single family home for very specific reasons. That holds true if you're looking for assisted living. Not everybody wants to be around 40, 50, 80, 100, or in some cases, 1,200 other people. They don't want to walk down 100-yard hallways. They don't want to live in a mini apartment inside of this big, massive hospital with a better paint job, my friend calls them. And or in some cases, a cruise ship that doesn't move, right? So they're just so big and impersonal. I'm not against big buildings, but I do think the outcomes delivered by residential assisted living, or what I really call small assisted living facilities, you know, 20 or under, 16 and under, the outcomes so much better. They fall less. They usually do better with food. Memory loss issues, cognitive impairment issues respond much better to small environments. The data on that's very clear. And so you have this segment of people that they want gyms and chandeliers and they want, you know, buses to the casino. And you have this other segment of people where they care about food, communication, and care. And that's it. And so I'm building a campus where it's all care homes on one campus. Mm-hmm. So a neighborhood, you pull up and there's six houses and there are 16-bed assisted living facilities instead of a neighborhood. It looks just like a neighborhood. Other than that, you have green space, outdoor space. You have an admin building that's kind of like almost like a leasing office or an admin office that you'd see like on an apartment complex or on like a new community that's selling lots or whatever. So you have all the scaling of a big building all on one campus, but you're still licensed as a separate facility with a smaller environment. So the example is that in a big building, if you've got 16 residents in one wing and one resident in another, you're staffing for 17. In our model, if you have 16 in one building and one in another, you're staffing for 16 in one.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference.
Yeah.
And then you have all kinds of things like, you know, you have an open kitchen, so the residents can interact with the food, they can participate in it, you know, they can assist. And then also too, just watching a chef prepare a meal or setting the table. These things are all really positive things for residents to do that you just can't do in a big building. So my ground up development, the primary reason why it's different is really the clustered design, the sort of planned care home community, mm-hmm. so that we can have a bunch of different things on one campus. It's awesome because if you're in assisted living, at some point you graduate to needing dementia care, well, now your move is next door and you literally may be able to get the same exact room type, you know, maybe even the same room in the house next door. So that's kind of a cool concept. And of course, you have all the advantages that come with that. Makes it so much easier for us to manage. And then of course, with ground up, we can put all the amenities that we want to ensure that the house is designed in the right way.
Yeah, I love that idea. That's really innovative. Yeah, that's an awesome solution to the problem. And then you're sort of capturing the economies of scale because everything's so close together. There's so many benefits to doing that. That's awesome.
Well, they scale instantly. The biggest mm-hmm. the biggest problem that we don't talk about much in residential assisted living is that you just, if you have a 10-bed facility or you have even two 10-bed facilities, you don't have enough revenue to make money and pay everyone to do everything you need to be done. So a lot of owners, like I've been involved for a long time, and a lot of our students, their owners are involved and they're wearing the administrator hats. They're wearing the marketing hat. They're doing this. And there's nothing wrong with that. I highly recommend that in the beginning. But at a certain point, you have to make a decision. Do you want to help 30 people or do you want to help 300? Do you want to help 300 or do you want to help 3,000? And you can do that question, so on and so forth. But the more people you help, the less you can do in the day-to-day.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, that's really hard. And so for me, what I realized is that for me to be able to help, you know, because one of my communities has 96 beds in phase one, the other one has 80 beds, so it's a total of 176 beds. I'm literally going to take my company, I'm going to 4X it. And, you know, so I can't do that if I'm, you know, ordering groceries or I'm, you know, helping cook hamburgers at the house, or, you know, I'm having to interview all the care. I just can't do it. And so I had to consciously say, you know, what if I had to build a perfect place that not only gave us the outcomes that we wanted, but also gave us so many amenities and so many benefits. Like my new communities will have transportation. I'll have a van. Whereas with my Dallas operation, I don't, you know, mm-hmm. so we're able to solve all the problems that you sort of have in residential assisted living with scaling. You also solve some of the finance problems as well, because, you know, a commercial piece of land that's got 96 bed facilities, banks understand that. You know, you go to a bank and say, hey, I want to take this house and convert it to assisted living. They're like, I don't know what you're doing. What is that? And there's some confusion there. But at the end of the day, the number one thing, the most important thing is the outcome. You know, we want people not to fall. We want people to feel safe. We want people to have a good time. We want them to not be depressed. We want them to eat nutritious meals. We want them to have a sense of purpose. We want them to be able to go outside if they want to. All those things are much easier to achieve in a small setting. And I'm committed to the outcome and I'm trying to design a campus that gives us the outcome, but also solves the scaling problem.
Yeah, I love that. And I love your mentality behind that for sure. When it comes to funding such a large project, what's the main method of doing that? Is it through loans? Is it through investors? Is it a combination of both?
Yeah, so we do a couple things. We generally get construction loans. So for example, the project we're doing in Denton, it's about an $18 million project. Our construction loan's about $12 million. We'll get equity of about $6 million. We'll put some of that money in personally, but we also raise the money with investors.
Mm-hmm.
So we've kind of been able to create a product that allows investors that are accredited. You know, I know that may not be something you'll talk about a lot in your world, but an accredited investor is basically a federal government guideline on who's eligible to invest in certain projects. It doesn't mean they know anything. You don't have to go to school to become accredited. It just means you have a certain net worth or you make a certain amount of income. And the federal government has said, hey, if you make a certain amount of money or you're worth a certain amount, you can handle risk better. So our projects, we deal with mostly, you know, middle to high net worth individuals and usually do $100,000 minimum, sometimes a little less, but you know, usually investing from $100,000, maybe to $1 million. And they invest alongside of us. We do everything turnkey and then they get quarterly, they get sent a check or an ACH with a return on their investment. They participate in, you know, every little stream of the business. And one day when we go to sell, they get a big check then too. So that's mm-hmm. kind of the model that we use. So it's called syndication. So basically we're pooling various investor resources that are passive. So on a typical project, we might have 30, 40 or 50 investors You know, some investing 100,000, some investing a million, you know, whatever the case may be. And, you know, they're getting the lion's share of the profit from the deal, as they should, because they're the one taking the capital risk. And of course, we're being compensated as the managers and being, we're also getting a piece of the deal for putting it all together and things to that nature. So it's a great way for us to accomplish two goals. One, I can help all the people that need our services, need assisted living, need memory care. But also, two, I'm not a big fan of Wall Street. I'm not a big fan of what I call paper wealth, right? So a lot of Wall Street is, you know, you give somebody you don't know very well money and you hope they can produce extra money on, and they're taking lots of fees. And then where does that money go? It usually goes to New York. It doesn't actually help Main Street. So what I like about this is that literally we have, most of our investors are Texas. We have quite a few all over. You can literally invest in something, jump in the car one day with your kid and drive past and go, hey, your mom or dad owns, mom or dad owns that assisted living facility right there. We're one of the owners.
Yeah.
And so there's all kinds of legacy stuff that families can do. And frankly, do you really want to own a tobacco mutual fund, or do you want to help people that are falling and need meals and need attention? And so a lot of people really resonate with the idea that it's capitalism, but it's capitalism with a conscience. It has a purpose.
Awesome. Yeah. I love it. And we are already past our time. That went by so quick.
I have a tendency to do that to people. I'm sorry about that.
No, you're good. I'm glad that we were able to get as much in as we did. It just went by so quick. So if anybody's interested in investing with you or learning more about you or connecting with you, I'll let you share that info one more time.
Sure. Yeah. So the best way to get a hold of me is our website is thesageoak.com, thesageoak.com. You can click on the info link, that'll go to me, or you can also email me directly at loe@thesageoak.com. One thing I'll say is that you don't need to email me if you're interested in investing. We don't do it like that. Email me if you want to learn more about us. Email me if you want to get into a relationship with us. The vast majority of people that invest with us, we've talked with them half a dozen times. We've met them in person, or we've known them for a while. And so our number one goal is, I don't want anyone to think like, oh, I'm not ready to invest, I don't want to email them. That's fine. This could be a 2-year process, a 1-year process, doesn't matter. You have any questions, you want to learn more about the business, please feel free to reach out. And, you know, if we get into your relationship and investing makes mutual sense, happy to do that. If it's not a fit for one of us, no worries. There's plenty of other projects we can point you to.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome, Lo. Well, thank you for jumping on the podcast. Totally appreciate it, sharing your wealth of knowledge.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Healthcare Entrepreneur Academy. Want to connect with more like-minded healthcare entrepreneurs and professionals? Just head over to jasondeprat.com/group to join our Facebook family for real-time interactions, insight, and resources to get you one step closer to realizing your goal. We look forward to interacting with you, but until then, we'll catch you on the next episode of the Healthcare Entrepreneur Academy.